The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Abduction, where the debunkers went wrong. Betty and Barney Hill are best known as the first alien abduction experiences to stir worldwide attention, because of their 1961 UFO abduction. Their story might have faded into the annals of preposterous claims except for the fact that the Hills were credible people with no prior interest in the topic. Debunkers have disseminated false and misleading information about Betty's interest in the topic, stating that she was a long-time believer in UFOs and had read many books and articles on the subject. Additionally, it has been falsely stated that Betty was a science fiction enthusiast who watched many movies pertaining to UFO abduction. This is nonsense. The facts are partially documented in a letter written by Barney to Major Donald Kehoe, director of NICAP. Barney wrote, "I was a skeptic prior to this UFO sighting, although my wife felt they could exist. Neither of us had any training or knowledge in the past. Despite this fact, one so-called skeptic wrote that the story has every indication of being merely an inventive tale from the mind of a lifelong UFO fanatic. This is an outright lie." NICAP investigator Walter Webb, an astronomy lecturer at the Hayden Planetarium, who had worked with J. Allen Hayek, Ph.D., and was later promoted to assistant director, asked the Hills about their prior interest in the topic. He wrote in an article dated 30 August 1965, "Before the experience, Barney Hill apparently had a total lack of interest or curiosity about UFOs. His wife had a mild interest in the heavens which she shared with her father, but she had not read any books on the UFO subject. The fact is that my family was interested in the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union. The interest did not extend to the topic of extraterrestrial visitation, with one brief exception. In 1957, my mother, Janet Miller, had stopped her car at the side of the road to observe a truly perplexing object hanging in the night sky. She and several witnesses from a nearby house watched in amazement as a number of disc-shaped objects approached the larger craft from different directions and entered it. Next, it ascended into the night sky and disappeared from sight. My mother mentioned this in passing conversation to my grandparents and Betty and Barney during a family visit, but Barney stated that there had to be a prosaic explanation for it. Betty thought that it might be possible, but the conversation ended there and it wasn't mentioned again until September 20, 1961, when Betty phoned my childhood home and apprised my mother of the close encounter that she and Barney had the previous evening in New Hampshire's White Mountains. It was then that I heard about my mother's UFO sighting for the first time. I was 13. 1. False information about the Hills' credibility. I stated above that the Hills were credible people. It is a point that is often ignored by debunkers who have an agenda to color them as anything but credible. I've read the false charges that Betty was fantasy prone and Barney was mentally unstable. Complete nonsense. The fact is that Betty and Barney were well grounded, stable individuals. Several people that knew Betty as a friend or adoption worker have made comments to me about Betty's personality. The most frequent comment I receive is she was the salt of the earth. The people that criticize her don't know what they're talking about. I have never received a negative comment about Betty or Barney by anyone that knew them. It has long been argued by debunkers that Betty's personality was so dominant and Barney's was so submissive that he would do, say and believe anything that Betty told him to. This is another blatantly false accusation. The personality tests administered to them by Dr. Leo Sprinkle indicate that Barney scored within the normal range on measures of suggestibility, self-confidence, self-doubt, excitability, inhibitions, disposition, conformity and anxiety. His scores were above average in the areas of perseverance, responsibility, achievement, self-control, commitment to truth and justice, sincerity, dependability, self-discipline, and hard work. He had a mind of his own and a healthy sense of self. The fact is that Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire, working in child welfare and adoption, and Barney was employed by the U.S. Post Office. Both were active in the civil rights movement and lifelong members of the NAACP. Barney was legal redress officer for his local chapter and on the regional board. In a letter dated May 21, 1965, Barney was informed by a representative from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, "It gives me great pleasure to advise you that the United States Commission on Civil Rights, at a meeting held May 4, 1965, appointed you a member of the New Hampshire State Advisory Committee for a term ending December 31, 1966. This recognition would not have been awarded to a submissive or mentally unstable man. It was Barney's advocacy for equal rights that brought him to the committee's attention. Prior to his appointment, he had voiced concern in a letter to the editor about how ridiculous it was for the committee to be staffed by five white men, although there were many people of color in the state. He considered this unfair and discriminatory. Valerie Cunningham is an African-American historian from Portsmouth who knew Barney and addressed this issue in an interview in the film titled Strange Septembers. She said, "Barney was fearless and outspoken. These are not the activities of an effete man." Betty and Barney worked tirelessly with a team of volunteers from Portsmouth, NH to set up the Rockingham County Community Action Program through the U.S. Office of Economic Opportunity. Barney served on the board of directors in this program. They also worked to promote voters' rights and literacy, and for their efforts were invited by President Lyndon B. Johnson to attend his 1965 inauguration. "I received an invitation as well, and accompanied Betty and Barney to the historic event. This was before the violation of confidentiality that resulted in the public disclosure that the Hills had been abducted by aliens. Prior to this, only a few scientists, UFO investigators, close friends and family members were privy to this information, and we had been sworn to secrecy knowing the negative consequences that this kind of publicity could deliver to my family." Inaugural invitation. Senator Thomas McIntyre and Barney. Both Betty and Barney performed their jobs well. After receiving an honorable discharge from the Army, and being assessed as having excellent character, Barney landed a job with the U.S. Post Office. He remained employed at the Post Office until his death in 1969. Betty was promoted to intake and referral supervisor at the Welfare Office after her abduction story was made public. False statements about their trip to Niagara Falls. Debunkers often speculate authoritatively, but without knowledge, that Barney was under so much stress prior to his and Betty's vacation to Niagara Falls and Montreal that he had intended to use the time to rest. This is another blatantly false and irrational statement. If it were true, the Hills could have remained at home or vacationed nearby. The facts can be found in Barney's statement to Dr. Benjamin Simon, the prominent Boston psychiatrist who saw the Hills over a six-month period in 1964, for hypnosis regarding their 9/19/1961 experience. Dr. Simon asked Barney, "Tell me what made you suddenly decide to go to Niagara Falls?" Barney replied, "Betty had never been to Niagara Falls and she had a vacation for a week, and I had been. But I knew she wanted to go somewhere. I made that decision when I was driving down to work at night and I was thinking, I wish there was something I could do with Betty, while she was off from work for a week. And when I got to work I started to call her back, and then I thought, I will tell her in the morning when I get off from work and drive back to Portsmouth." 3. I suspect that Niagara Falls came to Barney's mind, because my aunt, Betty's sister, uncle, cousin and I vacationed there during the summer of 1961. We had thoroughly enjoyed ourselves and shared photographs and memories of the trip with Betty and Barney during a weekend visit. I recently heard another false statement on a National Geographic documentary that I appeared on. It was disappointing that I had made an abundance of accurate and informative points about my aunt and uncle's UFO experience. But a debunker falsely stated that the Hills had been driving for something like 16 hours that day before they sighted the UFO, implying that their minds were unlikely to see things objectively in that exhausted state. The fact is that the Hills had a restful night at a motel only 2 hours west of Montreal on September 18, and spent a lovely afternoon in Montreal. They had planned on spending the night on the outskirts of the city, but decided to continue on their route to Portsmouth, an H, as Barney was feeling energized and felt that it wouldn't be a problem. They had a contingency plan to stop for the night if he began to experience fatigue. In a conscious interview with Dr. Simon, Barney stated the following: "I was well rested from the night before. We had spent a delightful day and I knew I could drive on from the White Mountains down to Portsmouth. So, I didn't stop. I didn't feel too tired." The fact is that they had been driving only 5.5 hours when Betty spotted a new star-like object in the sky that had moved rapidly upward. How does 5.5 hours translate into 16 hours in the mind of a debunker? It appears that this debunker hasn't done his homework. It would have taken closer to 16 hours to drive home from Niagara Falls via Toronto, Montreal, Coaticook, and then down US Route 3 to I-93 to Route 4 to Portsmouth, an H. Two books, Fuller and Friedman Marden, stated that Betty and Barney spend the night before their UFO sighting at a motel 112 miles west of Montreal. They slept in on the morning of September 19 and had a leisurely breakfast before they made the two-hour journey to Montreal. "Last summer my husband and I tested the hypothesis that Betty and Barney were so tired that they weren't thinking clearly. We drove to Niagara Falls, went sightseeing, and spent the night at a hotel. The following morning, we drove along the north side of Lake Ontario east through Toronto and onward to a motel located approximately 112 miles west of Montreal. We enjoyed a leisurely morning and a nice breakfast, just as the hills did on September 19, 1961, and proceeded to drive to Montreal. We spent the afternoon there and left on the same route that Barney took to Coaticook and on toward Colebrook, an H. We stopped in Colebrook for a snack, just as Betty and Barney did, and headed south along their route toward Francania Notch. My husband and I are nearly 25 years older than the hills were when they made their interrupted journey, but we were not in an exhausted state. We didn't have hallucination of a UFO and its crew. False statements about the UFO sighting, 4, time and time again. I have read the false statements that Betty and Barney had observed a bright star-like UFO that seemed to be following them, and although it increased in size, it remained star-like. Because Barney feared that it might harm them, he left the main highway for narrow mountain roads and arrived home 2 hours later than expected. This is complete hogwash. The fact is that the bright star-like UFO quickly descended in their direction in an erratic flight pattern. At first the hills observed the lighted row of windows that gave it a cigar shape. Shortly thereafter, almost directly in their path, Betty and Barney encountered the flattened circular disc, hovering silently an estimated 100-200 feet above their vehicle. Barney rapidly brought the car to a halt in the middle of the road and grabbed his binoculars for a closer look, opening the car door for a less encumbered view. Rapidly, in an arc-like movement, it shifted from its location directly ahead, and rested above the apple treetops in an adjacent field. Barney walked toward it. The silent enigmatic craft was huge, maybe 60 to 80 feet in diameter, with a row of rectangular windows extending across its rim. As he approached it, two red lights at the end of fin-like structures parted from the sides of the craft, and it tilted toward Barney. Lifting his binoculars to his eyes, he spied a group of figures dressed in black, shiny uniforms looking back at him. In a letter dated September 26, 1961, only 6 days after their abduction, Betty wrote to NICAP director Donald Kehoe, "He, Barney, did see many figures scurrying about as though they were making some hurried type of preparation. One figure was observing us from the windows. From the distance this was seen, the figures appeared to be about the size of a pencil, and seemed to be dressed in some type of shiny black uniform. A star-like object? Not in the documented evidence." On October 21, 1961, he told NICAP investigator Walter Webb that they were somehow not human. As the craft tilted downward and began to descend toward him, one of these strange creatures, who remained at the window, communicated a frightening message. Barney had the immediate impression that he was in danger of being plucked from the field. Overcome with fear and with all of the courage that he could muster, He tore the binoculars from his eyes and raced back to the car. Breathless, trembling, and in near hysterics, he told Betty that they needed to get out of there or they were going to be captured. 5. Betty informed Donald Kehoe of Barney's response to observing the non-human entities staring down at him only 6 days after their encounter and after she had checked out a book at the library that listed Nicap's address. She wrote, "At this point, my husband became shocked and got back in the car, in a hysterical condition, laughing and repeating that they were going to capture us. To impart the impression that the hills observed only a bright, star-like object, or that all of this was brought out under hypnosis is simply dishonest. Now for Barney's turn off the main highway." As Barney resumed his drive down US Route 3 in Lincoln, an H, he told Betty to roll down her window and look up at the craft that had shifted over the car as he fled from the field. All she saw was blackness. There were no lights from the craft, no stars above, even though it was a bright, light night. Suddenly, she and Barney heard a series of code-like buzzing sounds that seemed to be striking the trunk of the car. This caused the car to vibrate and for a tingling sensation to pass through Betty and Barney's bodies. Then, as if only a moment had passed, the hills found themselves 35 miles south of the Lincoln field. They heard a second series of buzzing sounds, but this time they didn't see the craft. Barney did not intentionally turn off the main highway, nor did he travel on narrow mountain roads. Both retained a vague memory of leaving the main highway, but it was without intent. Later, they would discover that somehow found themselves on a state highway, Route 175, that runs parallel to Route 3, the main highway. Prior to this unexpected stop at the field, Barney had been looking for a highway patrolman. He wanted to report the UFO to a third witness. Now he and Betty had to reconcile the fact that they were suddenly and without explanation, miles south of their former location. They consciously recalled observing a fiery orb that seemed to be moving, although they weren't moving, and a roadblock. A Nazi crew? Baloney. Several UFO believers have twisted Barney's observation of non-humans aboard the craft and presented it as evidence that Nazi officers were working in concert with the Greys. This belief is not supported by the evidence when one examines Barney's conscious recall taken together with his hypnotic recall. On October 21, 1962, Barney described to NICAP investigator Walter Webb the non-human figures that he observed on the craft through binoculars. Walter wrote the figures reminded the observer of the cold precision of German officers. They moved smoothly and efficiently and showed no emotion. The fact is that Barney had served in the army during WW2 and was attempting to draw a comparison between the movement of the non-human entities and German officers in order to give Walter a way to visualize their efficient movement as a group. To say that this indicates Barney encountered Nazis is a huge stretch of the imagination. Now let's examine Barney's statements under hypnosis. First, it is important to understand the methods that Dr. Benjamin Simon employed. He did not use the technique that is used today, 6, when hypnotherapists work with suspected abductees. He was a psychiatrist and used hypnoanalysis with Barney. In other words, he had no interest in a possible UFO abduction. His primary interest was in identifying troubling events in Barney's past that reminded him of the emotional response he was experiencing when he viewed the craft's occupants. The past was being tied to the present. As Barney relived the events in the terrifying close encounter field that had troubled him for months prior to his hypnosis, he had a powerful abreaction, release of emotion, and became so confused that he incorrectly remembered that he had already removed his gun from the trunk of Betty's car miles earlier, when he worried about bears at the Mount Cleveland picnic area. This is evidence of his state of shock. His terrified mind does not want to relive this event, but Dr. Simon has forced him to move on. In addition to experiencing it, Dr. Simon had given Barney instructions to tell him all of his thoughts and feelings related to this event. As Barney relived the event under hypnosis in 1964, he stated, "And the evil face on the dot dot looks like a German Nazi. He is a Nazi. Certainly Barney had not described a Nazi to Walter Webb in October 1961. Nor did he later describe the non-human entities as having a Nazi appearance. Yet based upon this tiny statement made in a state of terror, under hypnosis, in hypnoanalysis, some individuals with a clear Nazi UFO agenda have expanded this momentary psychological interpretation to mean that Barney was abducted by Nazis working in concert with the Greys. Barney also stated that he felt like a rabbit. Using the same logic, would it be safe to say that Barney transformed into a rabbit? More attention should be given to Barney's conscious recall. Misleading statements about the weather. One debunker wrote an article stating that Betty spoke in error when she stated that the sky was clear on the night of her UFO sighting, and therefore should not inspire confidence in the accuracy of the rest of her testimony. He claimed to have contacted the Mount Washington weather station and other weather stations throughout New England, who informed him that at the time of the incident high, thin cirrus clouds covered more than half the sky. In order to verify this debunker's statements, I contacted the director at the Mount Washington weather station and requested its weather report for the night in question. Tim Markle, chief meteorologist at the Mount Washington Observatory, wrote, "It appears that the 19th and 20th were beautiful late summer days atop the rock pile. The evening and nighttime conditions on the 19th were quite tranquil. Visibility was 130 miles throughout the night." This neither confirmed nor denied the debunker's statement, so I researched the characteristics of high, thin cirrus clouds and discovered that they are virtually invisible at night. Stars can easily be seen through them. Betty's statement that it was a light, bright night was absolutely correct. This should inspire confidence in the accuracy of the rest of her testimony, if we follow the debunker's logic. 7. The same debunker postulated that the Hills' hysterical excitement had caused them to misinterpret the planet Jupiter as a UFO. He ignored the fact that the Air Force had considered, but rejected this explanation years earlier. The Air Force's Project Blue Book, known for dismissing even the most compelling UFO cases, stated in its report that there was a strong inversion in the Lincoln, an H-Arian on the night of the sighting. I asked a senior meteorologist to research the U.S. Weather Service's archival records for this date and received the following reply: "The light east airflow that night could have caused subsidence warming, just the opposite of an inversion as claimed by the Air Force." False statements made through official channels and debunking organizations demonstrate that emotionality is a prominent factor in their decision making. Either they are fearful of the possible social or economic consequences if the truth was told, or they themselves are scared silly. Misleading statements about 2 hours missing time. Years ago, a debunker attempted to explain away the period of lost time noted by the Hills, simply by contending that they were lost and couldn't find their way for 2 hours. The fact is that both stated under hypnosis that they had discovered they were on a new stretch of road with no plausible explanation for how they arrived there. They recalled observing a fiery orb on the road that was moving, although they weren't moving under roadblock, but they didn't know where this occurred. Barney was particularly concerned, because it is impossible to unintentionally turn off US Right 3 onto Right 175 along this section of highway. One has to come nearly to a complete stop and turn left over a bridge crossing the Pemigewasset River, then stop at a stop sign in order to turn onto Right 175. In separate hypnosis sessions in which amnesia was reinforced, both stated that immediately after they heard buzzing sounds on the trunk of their vehicle, they found themselves in a new, unfamiliar location. It is as if the craft had lifted their car and set it down in a new location, or Barney was under a mind-controlling force that directed him to make a turn without consciously intending to. Whatever occurred, we'll never know for certain. The Hills wouldn't have been lost for long. Visible road signs clearly mark several right turns off Right 175 and easily guide a person back to US Right 3. Betty and Barney drove along these routes repeatedly in late 1961 and 1962, searching for the spot where the fiery orb had landed, and sporadically thereafter. They didn't find it until Labor Day weekend 1965. but very significantly the exact location that they remembered under hypnosis. Several researchers have incorrectly stated that the hills drove along Right 3 around Squam Lake and the west side of Lake Winnepesaukee. This would have added time to their trip, but it is not the route that Barney took. He clearly stated that he traveled along Right 3 to Right 3 B to I-93, as shown on the map below. 8. Physical and circumstantial evidence. Debunkers would have us believe that there was no compelling evidence that anything unusual occurred to the hills on the night of September the 19th to the 20th, 1961. This too is a false claim. The facts speak for themselves. When Betty and Barney arrived home, they discovered that the tops of Barney's best dress shoes were so badly scraped that he had to replace them with new shoes. He and Betty had no memory of how this occurred. The dress that Betty had been wearing was in fine condition when she dressed on the morning of September 19, but when she arrived home it was torn in three places. There was a two-tier in the stitching at the top of her zipper and a one-tier in the thick zipper fabric. Additionally, the lining was torn from waist to hemline and the hem was torn down on one side. There was no prosaic explanation for the damage to Betty's dress. Betty discovered highly polished concentric circles on the trunk of her car that hadn't been there the previous day. They were in the exact location where the hills had heard buzzing sounds striking their trunk after the UFO shifted above their vehicle. I observed them only 2 days after the hills' close encounter. My childhood neighbor, a physicist, had advised Betty to take a compass to her car to determine whether or not it would react in an unusual way, not just fluctuate over the metal surface or in proximity to the battery. Betty discovered the circular marks and placed the compass over them, which caused the needle to whirl. Barney confirmed Betty's finding when he experimented with the compass. But time and time again, debunkers state that Barney did not observe anything unusual. Their trick was to quote a statement of denial that Barney made to Betty because he was irritated with her at that moment. He wanted to forget the whole thing and was being disagreeable for that reason. The fact is that he told Dr. Benjamin Simon, "I put the compass close to it, the spots, and the compass would spin and spin, and I could move the compass as few inches to a spot on trunk that did not have a spot and the compass would drop down, and I could not understand this." Debunkers that quote statements out of context for the purpose of misleading the public are being dishonest. The couple's wind-up wristwatches had stopped and they assumed that they needed to be rewound. Despite all efforts, they never ran again. This is circumstantial but seems more than a coincidence, particularly when we consider the effect that a strong electromagnetic field can have upon a watch. There was more circumstantial evidence than is mentioned above, but space limitations prevent me from discussing it in this paper. Please refer to my book, with Stanton T. Friedman, Captured: The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, for the full story, including Newington, New Hampshire's Pease Air Force Base and North Concord, Vermont's Air Force Station's Project Blue Book reports. Scientific analysis of Betty's dress. One debunker has stated that he can think of prosaic explanations for the torn and degraded condition of the dress Betty was wearing on the night of September 19, 1961. His exact words were, "The lining and zipper are torn," supposedly confirming her account of the aliens forcibly removing it from her, although a number of earthly explanations come to mind. Personally, I can think of no valid prosaic explanation for the damage to Betty's dress. Is he accusing her of intentionally damaging her dress? It sounds to me like he is making a thinly veiled attempt to defame Betty's character. How can this explain the biological growth in specific dress locations? Betty couldn't have doctored the dress for testing that was not even in existence, DNA, or known to her, ear, in the 1960s. Betty stated that her favorite blue dress was in fine condition when she dressed for her ride from Eastern Ontario to Montreal. She and Barney went sightseeing in Montreal and then traveled east toward New Hampshire. They stopped briefly for a snack in Coaticook, Kent Colebrook, and H., before heading south on US Right 3. She stepped out of the car to observe the UFO through binoculars at the Mount Cleveland picnic area and at the Old Man of the Mountain. This was her last conscious memory of exiting her vehicle until she arrived home at 5 o'clock on the morning of September 20.